Senate will likely as well. So those doesn't.
participating. And the very tools of the digital revolution, the ability to share things on the internet and search large amounts of data, those tools are absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, looking at genetic data and understanding, okay, why are some people predisposed to this and what goes on during these diseases, the research agenda of our foundation couldn't be anywhere near as ambitious without the digital revolution and the huge funding for the NIH that has built up that level of scientific knowledge. And so, there's certainly a lot of companies that aren't focused on the needs of the poorest. But I think that's okay. I don't think the balance is shifting away from them. In fact, when I go to Silicon Valley and I talk to the people who have been successful there, I talk about a few of those technologies like monitoring health. Yes, it'll be used for people in their exercise program, but you know, we'll take those same kind of health watches and we'll use them for people in clinics who are actually, you know, have infectious disease in Africa.
Is this a health watch?
No. This is a $10 watch. Even though the term trickle down, you know, sounds bad, for a lot of these things, getting the cell phones out, getting these networks set up, we are able to see huge benefits from that revolution. And that's another thing when you have this glum mood that people are in. They don't see that innovation is actually moving faster today than ever before, both here in the U.S. on things like how we educate kids and on these global health issues.
There's a little bit of a Fitbit craze in D.C. How do you feel about Fitbit?
It's a first generation of devices where, you know, the Apple Watch is a second generation, where eventually this ability to see how am I sleeping, is there anything going on with my heart rate or my calories that are of concern, we'll be able to track our health far, far better. And it'll be very easy. You can have contests with your friends. So it's the beginning of a phenomenon that's very positive.
Now, I want to ask, we haven't talked about another one of your campaigns today, which is your giving pledge with Warren Buffett. We talked a little bit about how hard it is to sell Congress and the American people on foreign aid. Is it harder to do that than it is to sell billionaires on the idea that they should give all their money away?
We're not saying to give it all away.
So that's the key part of the selling point.
They get to keep enough to do fairly well. Now, the Giving Pledge is a group that's come together to learn from each other who, you know, been very, very lucky with their success and are committing to give the majority of their wealth away. And we have an increasing membership. We're at 127 right now. And I think we'll get more and more people joining. I think the idea of giving smarter, giving earlier, giving even more generously, I do think that's catching on. And the U.S. is the envy of the world in this area. And so I was in India last week at a philanthropy forum, getting a lot of the successful people there talking about, yes, even though the government is pervasive and the government mistakes in that case are even more troubling, the idea of philanthropists doing pilot programs, mm-hmm. Showing the government how things can be done, whether it's sanitation or education or health, they're seeing the importance of philanthropy in America and thinking that they want to develop that, strengthen it and develop that same tradition. So philanthropy is absolutely on the rise, whether it's the tech sector, the finance sector. We have a lot of leaders that are coming in and helping us recruit more people. And the idea of how you'd be smart about philanthropy, it's kind of a world of its own, doesn't have the same feedback of profit and loss. So I'll spend tomorrow up in New York City. The whole afternoon is getting a bunch of the philanthropists together and talking about measurement. How mm-hmm. does it work? How much can you expect out of a well-done measurement system?
Right. I imagine it's a pretty competitive group.
Well, when you get into philanthropy, you're not quite competing the same way as you were when you were in the private sector.
You've won. So while we're on giving, all politics is local, and in an interview with Rolling Stone, you said, I don't give a lot of political contributions. Why not?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if somebody gives $1 million on one side and somebody else gives $1 million on the other side, you know, that's $2 million that could have gone to you know, a great charter school or inventing new vaccines or rolling things out. So, you know, I just don't choose to, pour money into that type of vehicle. I do normal kind of contributions, particularly for people who are going over to Africa and help highlighting global health. And that's tended to be pretty bipartisan in nature because of the coalition there exists, fortunately, around these global health issues. But I don't think my backing, putting a lot of money into political contributions is a way I'm going to try and help improve the world.
So the super PACs can back off.
Well, they know not to call me. I mean, no, they don't bother me because, once you set the precedent that that's not your game, they go elsewhere.
Although you have been supporting several causes that have increasingly become political lightning rods this year, whether it's your support for education reform and Common Core or gun control initiatives, for example. Do you see increasing polarization on those issues? Those are issues that you personally care a lot about, even if you're not engaging in traditional kind of campaign contributions.
Well, Common Core is, to me, a very basic idea that kids should be taught what they're going to be tested on and that we should have great curriculum material. Before Common Core, what existed where 50 states were all different and many of them weren't teaching kids what you were going to end up being tested on, it was such a cacophony and it was so low quality compared to other countries, particularly the Asian countries. You know, we had our math textbooks were twice size of Asian textbooks. So kids are carrying around this heavy thing, and you want to be intimidated by math, just give the kid a super big textbook. The Asians have these nice thin textbooks, and they really concentrate on teaching the concepts. And what are the results? Well, they spend far, far less money and get far, far better results. So Common Core, I would have thought of as more of a technocratic issue, the basic idea of should we share an electrical plug across the country? Well, you can get partisan about that, I suppose. Should Georgia have a different railroad width than everybody else? Should they teach multiplication in a different way? Oh, that's brilliant. Who came up with that idea? Common Core, the idea that what you should know at various grades, that should be well-structured, and you should really insist on kids knowing something so you can build on that. I did not expect that to become a big political issue. Fortunately, it's moving ahead, but there's been a lot of misinformation about what it is and, that the federal government wrote this thing or something like that. So you never know what's going to become political.
I think we have a question over here. Sir?
Yeah, John Wetmore with pedestrians.org. What's the role of civic leadership and local NGOs in health in West Africa?
Well, NGOs are absolutely fundamental in these countries. In a lot of cases where the government hasn't been able to invest in some of these cases because of civil war, a lot of the NGOs, including some of the Catholic-related ones, philanthropists who've come in and funded groups there, a lot of the capacity that exists comes from those NGOs. Now, over time, you'd like to reduce the dependency on NGOs. If you look at Ethiopia and Rwanda, as they put money into the government system, they got the NGOs to be very aligned. So they've got one supply chain system, one measurement system. And so, in fact, the NGOs are still there, but it's all part of one very coordinated system. In these countries, there was no overarching system. And so the hospitals that existed, the primary care centers, were mostly NGO-related. As we stitch it back together, you do want to have one overall system. But anybody who through their church or some other way, gives to those NGOs, they should feel great about the basic capability that put in place. Even in Nigeria, where we do see good health care, it's often the model of the NGO that allowed it to work as well as it does.
I'm going to come to the front row next, but while you're figuring out your question, in a 1994 interview, you said They asked if does privilege corrupt? And you said it's easy to get spoiled by things that alienate you from what's important. How do you personally resist, avoid that?
Well, if success corrupts, I'm probably pretty corrupted by now. I probably can't even recognize it. Our foundation tries to stay grounded by picking goals like childhood debt, childhood nutrition, you know, kids who get a four-year degree that's a high-quality degree. We try to ground ourselves by working on problems like that and seeing, you know, how tough it is. We try and get out in the field a lot and see where things are falling short of what, you know, we hoped would come together, hear from teachers about education, sit down with students. I'll get to do some of that later this week. I am very spoiled in terms of the types of interesting problems I get to work on and who I get to learn from. So I try and give back a little bit because it is so much fun to work on these problems.
One of the ways that you stay grounded is talking to young entrepreneurs. What do you look for, and everybody wants to pitch you, what do you look for in a young entrepreneur, a young business plan, a pitch?
Well, most pitches are about a product that's essentially already been done. The idea of finding something that's been hasn't been done, that's what's tough. And so either a breakthrough in understanding behavior, a breakthrough in understanding something that can be solved scientifically because computation has gotten so much more powerful. A lot of things weren't done in the past because computers were too slow and too expensive. And now the sky's the limit. Literally the idea of the computer being able to see what's going on, being able to understand speech, being able to take mass amounts of data and process that, the possibilities are quite incredible. And so the startups you'd want to see today are people who have really identified what can be done now that hasn't been done yet, and how are they going to maneuver quickly enough that the incumbents who have the benefit of scale and brand and field presence and all that aren't going to go and capture that opportunity. A lot of innovation, like most, is actually done once companies are founded. The most vaunted form is, oh, I'm starting a new company. And that's great. You know, it has this kind of mythic thing, and it's a very important element. But it's once the company gets going and is doing V2, V3, building up a large R&D team, actually even more of the advance comes through that piece. And so the entrepreneur who can carry through, bring in other talents as things scale up, that actually is often more scarce than even the good idea.
We have time for just one or two more quick ones. So.
Go ahead.
Joe Moore, avid playbook reader and PC fan. Two things. Can you comment on the importance of the primary point of care data that the Gates Foundation is working on, and with your programs in particular? And second of all, it's no secret that your foundation is changing the world of philanthropy. It's moving the needle in a way that we haven't seen before. How do you engage the next generation of Americans to really care and to move into that? Like, you have a whole room full of people who could go and change that. How is your foundation really doing that?
Well, philanthropy is about emotional connection, you know, taking your caring about the world and what your impact on it, and finding something that you really care a lot about. And so you can't really orchestrate what it is that people find. You can make sure they get lots of exposure, that in their own community they're seeing the social service organizations, and that they're kind of traveling the world and not just seeing the tourist part of it. I'm sure people find it a little confusing in terms of what should be picked. I did. Eventually, you really just have to pick, and you might not pick, you know, the most important thing, but then you're gonna get expertise, you're gonna develop metrics around it. You may, depending on the scale, build up staff or pick partners that you want to go after with it. And so, you know, then you have no choice. So, like, our commitment to infectious disease is that, you know, Melinda and I during our lifetime want to see that largely ended as a problem. And so we're going to stick to that as the primary cause. In terms of data, you know, what's missing is surprisingly basic. Do all the kids get vaccinated? Of the kids that are dying, were samples taken so you can find out, okay, is there something new going on with diarrhea or pneumonia that hasn't been detected? Do we need a new antibiotic? Does the vaccine have to change? And this basic feedback, so are the workers doing their job? Were the supplies there for them? Were they properly trained? And did we understand the disease burden in that area, what was causing problems properly? A lot of the measurement systems have been so macro that you get the data 3 years later and it's kind of at the country level. And that doesn't help you say, oh, the workers aren't showing up in this area. What we need is literally, at worst, quarterly data that's down at the individual primary health care center and know what's going on there. And that's where cell phones, digital systems, cameras, the ability to do very inexpensive data gathering is going to enable us to see the performance of these systems. When I was in India last week with Melinda going to the primary healthcare systems, that's a place where we've done pilot rollouts of the digital tracking so that the different workers, nobody forgets who's going to remind this mother to do the vaccination. If she doesn't come, who's going to follow up and try to make sure that happens? And in India, that was falling through the cracks in a high percentage of cases. And so now these new systems at very low cost, not much complexity, should be able to raise performance. And so it's not just this huge level macro, but really it is that one center that you know what's happening or not happening.
Who is a leader in Washington who you admire?
A leader in Washington I admire.
It's not a trick.
I think on education, the president and Arne Duncan have brought a lot. You know, the federal role in education, K through 12, isn't the central role. But by having race to the top and bringing visibility to what charter schools have done, how that could be expanded, taking the test data that came out of No Child Left Behind, which really did, it was bad news because it showed us how poorly the inner city was doing both in absolute and compared to the suburban schools. So No Child Left Behind was an advance. Now, nobody wanted to deal with all that bad news. It was like, oh, please stop telling us all that. Can't we shut that data source off? This administration coming in and saying, okay, with race to the top, let's find some positive outliers. Let's get behind them, whether it's teacher evaluation, use of technology, in a few places getting more kids into charter schools. There has been a positive set of steps in K through 12, and that took leadership. You know, telling the union that, hey, some degree of change you're going to have to be open-minded to, and we've had some change.
You are apolitical. You like smart people. You recently talked to Rand Paul. What did you find interesting about Senator Rand Paul?
Well, he has a view, many of which I would disagree with in terms of global engagement. But, you know, some of his critique of the fact that we need to do better, we need to bring higher quality to those things, we need to understand what we're trying to get done. Some of these global institutions, including even some of the UN institutions, aren't as well run as we'd like them to be. Now, the question of do we engage in improving that or do we disengage, that's where you'd find, you know, pretty different point of view.
Now, at the end, as you know, we always have a little fun. We're about to get the hook here, so I will ask you, what are you reading that we should read?
I just started this Henry Kissinger book called World Order, which is really good. You know, what is the paradigm that brings the whole world together? What do we have any shared values, or do we just have sort of a pragmatic view of how we don't have wars with each other. Anyway, I found that very enlightening. I had a call with the author of Capital in the 21st Century, Thomas Piketty, talking about his book and some things I agreed with him, some things I disagreed with him. That's a very important set of topics. How's wealth and income changed over time? How do government systems interact with that?
He just called you?
I called him. I'm writing a book review of his book, and so having time talking with him was extremely valuable for me.
Who's the book review for?
So I have a website called Gates Notes, and whenever I read books, including fiction books like Rosie Project to nonfiction, which is most of what I read, I generally write a review.
Now, at Playbook Cocktails, you only said one thing that was met with a little skepticism. You told us you read every word of The Economist every week. You still?
I do. I've already read this week's issue. I'm feeling very, very virtuous.
Okay, so we got Henry Kissinger. What did you read for fun this summer?
Well, the Piketty book took a lot of
fun.
But in terms of fun, the most fun book I've read for a long, long time, and it was this summer, is this one called The Rosie Project. And actually, the sequel called The Rosie Effect will be coming out in the U.S., I think, in about 2 or 3 months. The Rosie Effect, The Rosie Project, brilliant book. You find yourself laughing out loud. The reason I had to read it is my wife was laughing out loud so much while she read it that I thought, okay, there must be something good in there. So,
where did you go for fun this summer?
We went to Austria. My wife turned 50, and so we did a sort of Sound of Music-themed event and wore lederhosen and sang various songs that you'd expect.
You know, this interview is proving, I think, the old adage, which is that there's always the good stuff in the last 5 minutes.
So, penultimate question. You're a big tennis player. Give us one tennis tip.
It's a full body swing. It's not just your arms.
That's life.
Core strength is key.
And last question, you eat a lot of burgers. Why are you a burger guy?
I don't know. They're very easy to eat. You can go pretty much anywhere in the world and get a decent burger. India might not be your best choice for that.
Are you cheese or no cheese?
No cheese, usually.
Okay. And where do you get the best burger?
Well, I know all the local joints in Seattle, so there's one there called Dick's. But, you know, the Burger King, McDonald's, those are pretty good. you can't do a lot better than that.
You know, I'm not sure what to say except thank you very much. This has been a terrific and wide-ranging conversation, and luckily we have Mike here to make sure that it's lively. So thank you very much. I'm especially grateful to Bank of America, our partner on this, and to all of you for coming out to inaugurate this new series, Lessons
from All you live streamers,
the...
thank you.
Yes, and you can come to our website at politico.com and look at Lessons from Leaders and recap this conversation. Thank you so much, Mr. Keith.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
The Centers for Disease Control will hold a briefing Sunday to provide an update on the investigation into the first Ebola case diagnosed in the U.S. That's expected to begin at noon Eastern, and we'll have live coverage here on C-SPAN.
Next, more on the Ebola outbreak with a look at the U.S. response at home and abroad. Then our campaign 2014 coverage continues with the debate in the Montana at-large House district race. After that, another chance to see a conversation with Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates on the Ebola epidemic and other global health issues. On Newsmakers, Kansas Senator Jerry Moran, the National Republican Senatorial Committee Chair, talks about the 2014 election landscape around the nation, including the campaign of his fellow Kansas Senator Pat Roberts. Here's a portion of his remarks.
Here's somebody who's been around a long time. He is an incumbent. He's viewed as somebody who doesn't spend enough time in the state by many measures. Isn't that his biggest problem in this race?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I would say that the primary campaign, one of the slogans that was repeated time and time again was that Senator Roberts isn't a Kansan, or he what that is a representation of. It has the ability to be a campaign slogan. But boy, if you want to determine whether somebody is still a Kansan, look at their voting record. And that's what Kansans will ultimately see is how does Pat Roberts vote in the United States Senate? And what they will find is that he is voting, when we're given the chance to actually cast a vote in this place, that he is voting time and time again the way that Kansans would want him to. So it's a false issue. I understand that it had political resonance in the primary, but now when it comes down to a general election, the issue is, do you want somebody that you know how they're going to vote, who has voted many times and time again in support of the positions that the vast majority of Kansans hold, or do you want somebody who has said they support Obamacare, that they are for greater gun control, that they want the president to have greater leeway in judicial nominations? I just think there's a clear, stark difference here. Somebody that we know versus somebody that would be a significant risk, and the risk would be in the direction of things that most Kansans would find objectionable.
Kansas Senator Jerry Moran on Newsmakers, Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN. Now a discussion on the U.S. response to the Ebola epidemic, both at home and abroad. From today's Washington Journal, this is about an hour.
We're joined now by Dr. Gavin McGregor Skinner. He is an infectious disease expert with the Elizabeth R. Griffin Foundation. And Dr. McGregor Skinner, I also just want to note some of your other history because I think it's very interesting. You recently returned from Nigeria, where you were actually treating patients on the ground with Ebola. Previously, you had worked in preventing, controlling avian and pandemic influenza outbreaks. You also worked in helping prevent disease after the 2004 tsunami. You have an extensive background here in dealing with these outbreaks. So I'd like to get your thoughts off the bat about some of the latest headlines we've heard out of the Ebola outbreak. The Dallas officials have narrowed down to 10 the list of people who might be infected with Ebola or who might have been exposed to the spread of the disease. We see the death toll now worldwide is now over 3,300. Are we handling this epidemic in the right way?
Well, that's a really good question, Elaine. We have within the U.S. healthcare system wonderful trained healthcare staff, both paid and voluntary in our hospitals. And that just not just includes our doctors and our nurses, but all the auxiliary staff, our administration staff, we have them in place. What we really have at the moment is a hub and spoke type approach to this, to controlling Ebola. So we've put the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, in the center. And then we have all the healthcare systems, whether it be the hospitals, the urgent healthcare, the travel clinics, physicians throughout the country, in this hub and spoke. We haven't created a functional network. And that's what we need to create. And we need to be able to share experiences. So we've had Emory Hospital in Atlanta. We've had the Nebraska Medical Center, and they've treated patients successfully. They're our champions at the moment. And they should be telling us the stories, the challenges they face. And we know it's not easy treating an Ebola patient. It's really hard. It's very stressful. It's intense. It requires good management and good implementation. And every day you're faced with new challenges. We aren't hearing the challenges that were faced at Emory. We aren't hearing the challenges that were faced at Nebraska. And they aren't teaching that Texas has a new patient. Guys, tomorrow this is going to happen. Or this could happen. And this is what we did. And you may need to consider it now. And we're not sharing our experiences.
So you're saying there's a lack of communication between the hospitals that are dealing with this disease?
There is a need for much better communication. There is a need for teamwork. And we aren't working as a team. So at Penn State University, I teach public health preparedness. And the emphasis is all the time for all my students. And these are graduate students. I teach graduate students. They're in their 40s and their 50s. They've had many years of experience. And I'm telling them, you don't work as individuals. You know, here in the US, we have a wonderful democracy where we promote individual thought, creativity, innovation. But when it comes down to disasters and emergencies and highly infectious diseases, you have to get all the team together. And we haven't got the whole team together.
Well, it seems like part of the issue here might be education. I think that there's a lot of confusion, perhaps misperception, around exactly how Ebola is spread. Can you break it down for us, you know, how this disease travels from one person to another? What should we be concerned about?
Yes, and it's really important because we've heard the CDC director, Dr. Tom Frieden, we've heard from NIH, Dr. Anthony Fauci, world-renowned experts have said it's really hard to get this disease. And it's true. Having dealt personally with Ebola patients, how do I feel? I'm scared. I've got to be really honest. And the people in my team are scared, and we all work together to try to encourage and give each other confidence. But what we do know, if we put on the proper protection, the suits, the gloves, the shield, the face masks, the face shields, we know that, that the virus is in the bodily fluids. And we need to really define what that really means, because we talk about body fluids, and I have my two children at middle school going, Dad, what's a bodily fluid? Okay, a bodily fluid. We can have it in saliva. We know there's lots and lots of virus in blood. We know that that people that have Ebola, they vomit. They're sick. So there's virus in the vomit. A patient that has Ebola has to go to the toilet. When they go to the toilet, there is vomit. When they go to in the urine and the feces, when they have diarrhea, there's virus in the in the diarrhea. As we get as they get worse and worse and worse, there's more virus, and we start to see the virus in the sweat. The other really important thing that we haven't talked about is semen. There's also virus in the semen, and there's also virus in breast milk, and we haven't talked about that. And so at the early stages of the disease, when people are really sick and we're treating them, we have vomit, we have virus in all these bodily fluids, which we've just described. You have to touch those bodily fluids. It doesn't float in the air. You touch them, then it has to get into your body. It doesn't go through the skin. You have to put your hands in your mouth, your nose, your eyes. Now, we sit here each day and we do fun things at home, and my family think, well, okay, how many times do you touch your face in a day? And it's a lot. And people are out there in universities and academics are doing studies at the moment, looking at people, how many times do we touch our face? And it's a lot. It's a lot throughout the day. And so as we work with nurses and doctors and physicians and other specialists in the hospitals, don't touch your face. So when I do training in a hospital and I teach them the hospital infection control precautions that are needed for Ebola, I tell them, don't raise your hands above your shoulders. That's really hard to do.
So how much of the virus would it take to get infected? If you, as you said, just touching your eye after perhaps touching the bodily fluids of someone else could be enough.
Okay. When we look at, when you've got Ebola and we look at, the blood in your body, we take a blood sample, there's billions of virus in there. When someone with Ebola vomits, there's billions of virus particles on the ground. Someone has diarrhea and they're in bed and the sheets are all covered, there's billions of viruses. How much do we need? Probably one. Not very much at all. So it's, when you're working with Ebola virus, you have to get it 100% correct every time.
How long does a virus stay active once it's outside of the body?
It really depends on the surface that it's on. Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize right now, it's not days. So this virus dies. It's killed when on dry surfaces. So it may get onto a surface, and it may only last maybe up to 30 minutes. It may get onto other porous surfaces, and it may last 1 to 2 hours. Over a 24-hour period, we really believe, and from the research and the samples we've taken in hospitals, that over a 24-hour period, if it's outside the body, the virus is dead, and it's not contagious. And therefore, it can't be transmitted. So it's not days, it's more like hours.
We want to hear your thoughts on this outbreak and the U.S.'s response to it, and field your questions for Dr. Gavin McGregor-Skinner. You can call us on the Republican line at 202-585-3881, on the Democratic line at 202-585-3880. Independents can call 202-585-3882. Find us on social media on Twitter at CSPANWJ, on Facebook at facebook.com/CSPAN, or send us an email at journal@c-span.org. Earlier this week, the director of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Frances Collins, was here on the Washington Journal to talk about her work developing a vaccine for Ebola.
The vaccines are moving forward at an unprecedented rate, and I might say, this is an effort that we started 13 years ago, anticipating that there might be a need for a vaccine, because Ebola's been around since 1976, albeit in small outbreaks. This is the fifth generation Ebola vaccine. It looks very good in the animal models, where it seems to be completely protective. But of course, you don't know until you try this out in human patients whether it's going to be safe and whether it'll work. So we did start just 3 weeks ago what's called a phase one trial of this vaccine. 20 individuals have now been injected with that. They are volunteers here at the NIH Clinical Center. So far, all is going well. No red flags to indicate there's a problem with the vaccine, but it will take now a couple of months to see whether those individuals mount an immune response that you would think would be protective against acquiring the disease. Once we have those data, if they look promising, then we need to move quickly to get this into what you'd call a phase two trial in West Africa in individuals who are at risk. All of that's very complicated in a circumstance where in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, there's a great deal of stress, as you can imagine, on the healthcare system, and mounting clinical research studies is going to be challenging. But we're determined to figure out a way to do that.
What's the timeline then, Dr. Collins? What are you looking at?
Well, again, it'll be November before we have the evidence about whether the vaccine is looking promising in this phase one trial. If it looks good, then shortly after that, and there are meetings going on actually today and almost every day exactly about how to do the design, we would try to then set up this more extensive trial in West Africa that would determine whether the vaccine is actually effective or not.
That was Dr. Francis Collins from the National Institutes of Health talking about the agency's work in developing a vaccine for Ebola. Dr. McGavin Skinner, what is your take on how close we are to actually finding a cure and a prevention?
I'm not directly involved in the vaccine research, and we know that's a billion-dollar industry out there. And it's out there for diseases that are really common. So you have to take this from a business perspective. Are those pharmaceutical companies, those vaccine research companies that are out there, as well as government, are they in the business to make money or to save lives at the moment? And that's really important. So we've heard that, you know, this is a fifth generation vaccine. I've been involved in vaccine trials for influenza, both for bird flu and for pandemic influenza. And some of those vaccines looked promising, others failed. And so at the moment, all the treatment, the drugs we have, the vaccines we have, we're really at the animal testing stage, with the modeling stage. We haven't started all the trials that we need to do. And the real important thing about the U.S. healthcare system is we practice evidence-based medicine. We don't make guesses. We don't risk people's lives with the unknown. So until we have the empirical evidence, the data that our experts in this country have analyzed, then we've got to be really careful in what we're saying about the future for a vaccine. And then if we develop a vaccine, we may not have another Ebola outbreak for years. So where do people recoup the costs? And is this what's needed?
We will turn now to your phone calls. We will start with Paul from Pompano Beach, Florida, on the Republican line. Paul, go ahead.
Good morning. I've done some serious work in statistics myself, and I think we're way underestimating the true danger to the public. If you were to take the number one and double it 30 times, you'd have some idea of how quickly one becomes millions. And on any iteration of that doubling in this system of Ebola here, it could spread like wildfire. And I think that's the basic truth that's being held back.
Yeah, very good question, Paul. And I was talking to, I have a daughter in middle school, and we were talking about this last night. And she said, "Dad, would you like me to give you $1 million or pay you a penny that doubles every day for 30 days? And it's just like we were talking in the context of Ebola. We do have the resources. We do have the tools in the toolbox here. What we need to do is improve the communication, the awareness. We're very careful in this country, and this is working to our detriment at the moment, that we need to identify where the hospitals that are ready and where the hospitals aren't ready, where the health clinics that may be getting Ebola, and who do they contact. So again, there's two ways that two activities we need to focus on here. It's early detection, and then it's that contact tracing. And if we get the early detection correct and we get the resources out for contact tracing, we know from previous experiences with Ebola that we're going to beat this disease.
Next up is Robin from Old Forge, Pennsylvania, on the Democratic line. Robin, you're on the air with Dr. Gavin McGregor Skinner.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I am very worried about what is going on here with this Ebola.
Robin, turn down your TV. You're on the air.
Okay. I just I'm worried about what happened already with the case that happened in Texas. I don't think we're ready for this. The hospitals dropped the ball. And what if this happens in other hospitals and they're lying coming over here from other countries, from Africa and Liberia?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Robin, and I share similar concerns. I think we have to be very careful within the U.S. healthcare system and all the different processes we have. I can tell you the differences that, you know, I teach emergency management. We teach a whole community approach. It's really important that when we have a disaster, an emergency, whether it be a natural disaster like a hurricane or a tornado or a highly infectious disease like Ebola, we need everyone in the community to be involved, and we need them to be equal shareholders. And what's important here now is that we need to look at, again, I'll go back to this, the tools in the toolbox, the resources we have, and how we can improve our communication. I don't expect every nurse, every physician, every hospital worker in the country to be an A-grade student when it comes to geography. They don't need to know where Liberia or Guinea or Sierra Leone is. But what we need to put in, say, for example, our hospital electronic medical record systems, which we use, which is what was used in Dallas, and we heard yesterday from the officials in Dallas, we think it was a failure in our electronic medical record system. Well, I know when I talk to my IT data people that I work with all the time, if you put in any of those West African countries, let's make the screen flash red. And it means tell someone. And let's go back to what happened to old-fashioned communication between nurses and doctors. Don't blame that nurse. Don't put her on the fire. You know, she is a nurse in an emergency department. She has 1,000 things going on in her head. She has 1,000 activities to do. She's really busy. She's stressed every day. We've been there. But let's facilitate the system and let's help make the system. Where is the signs up at the front of the hospital saying, if you've just recently travelled, call this number or don't come into the hospital and we'll come to you? We haven't done that yet.
So there has been, to that point, some talk about sort of exactly where do we start to catch potential infections or potential folks who may be contagious. In the Financial Times, there was a story today that says clamor rises to ban flights from Ebola hotspots. Republicans calling for action as family of infected man is held under armed guard. Some of those who are joining this push are Bobby Jindal, the Republican governor of Louisiana, calling on the administration to shut down flights from countries afflicted by Ebola. There's also Rob Portman, an Ohio Republican senator, who said that a ban on flights should be considered, and Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, who attacked the White House's unclear approach and called for airports to take every precaution. Meanwhile, you have U.S. Senator John Cornyn from Texas yesterday, writing to U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Jill Kerlikowske to request additional information on the screening process for incoming passengers to the U.S. after the confirmed case of Ebola in Dallas. What are we doing in terms of airport screening, and is it enough?
I've just recently come back from Nigeria. When I was in Nigeria, I went through two airports in Nigeria. There were nurses at those airports. They took my temperature. They made me fill out a form, and then they asked me questions. So I was interviewed. I was interviewed twice. I then flew through Germany. And as I got off the plane, they knew I'd just come from Nigeria. There was nurses in the gangway. Before we'd even got into the airport, we got off the plane, walking up the gangway. Everyone, line up here. They came along, took our temperature. We filled out forms. We got interviewed. I then got on a plane from Germany to Washington, D.C., and there's nothing at the airport. Now, we have the resources, we have the people, we have the skills, we have the training to set up, and no one gave me again, there was no one there taking my temperature, no one asking me questions, I didn't fill out a form, there was no database, there's no history of me traveling from Nigeria after having worked with Ebola patients and stating that to immigration officers. And I don't blame them, but what I do, I blame the system at the moment. And I also, there was nothing handed out saying, if you get sick, ring this number.
So is that an argument for a full ban on flights to and from, or just an argument for a better screening process?
Well, I think we need a better screening process. I think we need a better follow-up in our contact tracing, but also just in people who have traveled from West Africa. And I'm seeing universities around the country have already taken this initiative. I work a lot with universities and the students that have come back. But I do want to talk about just the flights. A plane has two levels. You have the passengers at the top and the cargo at the bottom. I have a lot of friends working in West Africa now, risking their lives on Ebola. They're relying on medicines. They're relying on equipment, their personal protective equipment. There's a food security issue there. You ban the planes, my friends are going to suffer as they start to go through the personal protective equipment. In infectious diseases, we don't isolate countries. We isolate the virus. And that's what we need to be focusing on.
Next up is Marcel from Arlington, Virginia, on the independent line.
Yes, I think that the first earlier callers who were concerned about the spread to the United States are fairly correctly pointing to what may be a real problem for CDC, because within the last 2 or 3 weeks they have commented in medical journals that this outbreak could go over a million people. Now, even if it goes up to 50 or 60,000, it's very hard to believe that it will not spread to other countries in West Africa. I've lived over there for many years at different times over the last 40 years, and their airports are not as secure. That may be the case in Nigeria, but these people could show up in other places and come into the United States. I think you very accurately have pointed to a problem that we have here as people come into our airports, and that problem should be addressed immediately. The CDC really has a problem, because if this happens again, the public here will become hysterical. That's my belief. Thank you so much.
I think you're making a really good point, and you've mentioned the CDC, and I used to work at the CDC as a disease detective, and I have a lot of friends there, and we're called the Epidemic Intelligence Service Officers, and we went out to investigate outbreaks of any disease. What I'm really concerned about, and I know I've talked about this before, the hub and spoke. I teach public health preparedness and emergency management. It takes a team. We have the best emergency managers in the world, and I can honestly say that here in the US. We go around the world teaching disaster management, emergency management, with the curricula that we have. What we need at the moment here in the US, look at the incident command system, which was invented, designed, modified, strengthened, and it's a great system for managing any disaster. It's not just putting the CDC, who are the virus experts, in the center. It's bringing all the other assets within the government that can help us. And that's going to include Homeland Security, it's going to include Department of Transport and all the other agencies that we have and the departments that we have. And it's actually, we need good managers out there, people who can do good coordination, good collaboration, good communication, and let the CDC do what they do and they're real experts at, but don't put the added pressure of having them manage the whole event. And at the moment, we need managers for these events.
A few comments now from Twitter. John in North Carolina writes, with a 21-day incubation period, airport screening is worthless. I'd like to hear your comments on that one. And also, still an individual writes, it sounds like someone leaning on a counter or armrest at an emergency room after an Ebola patient's arms and sweat may have dripped there is at risk for half an hour. Does that sound accurate to you?
I'll do the bodily fluids first. Okay. Bodily fluids on the ground, if they're wet, the virus is still alive.
Okay.
What kills the virus is dry conditions, but we don't, in hospitals, we don't rely on that. We have to what's called decontaminate, and we use disinfectants or bleach or anything with chlorine in it. So if I go back to the hospitals I worked in Nigeria, we went down to the supermarket. We bought bleach off from the supermarket. We took that bleach back. Now, that bleach is anywhere from 3 to 5%. That's a little too corrosive for it to use in a hospital. So we had to teach the nurses and the hospital staff how to take the supermarket bleach and dilute it down to about 0.5%. A much lower concentration, which we know kills the virus 100%, but also doesn't cause everything to corrode. And it's not dangerous. Again, we're talking about occupational health here. It's not dangerous to the person. So any bodily fluids that are spilled need to be cleaned up. That's what you have to do. If we talk about screening at airports, there are a number of critical mission functions to detect, prevent, and stop the Ebola from spreading. Now, I know when I traveled from Nigeria, it was a 30-hour trip. When I left Nigeria, I was fine. When I went through Germany, I was fine. But my flight from Germany to the US, anything could have happened. When I went through the airport, I left and I didn't know what I was going to do. Even though I work with Ebola, in the next 21 days, I'm going to put myself under observation. And I'm going to work with my team too. We're going to talk to each other each day. How's your how are you feeling and how's your temperature?
But this brings up another important point, which is, as I understand it, Ebola is only contagious when someone is showing symptoms, not necessarily when they are in that incubation period.
That's
is that
right.
correct?
And so what we need to do as part of our airport screening is create awareness, create education. As you leave the airport, you've just come back from a country in West Africa, at least you have. And I'd like to point out that, again, I'll go back to my children. They're really smart. Dad, when you don't know something, just Google it. And so we're sitting there the other day talking about the poison emergency number in this country. If you Google poison emergency number, you get 1-800-222-1222. I said to my children, let's Google Ebola emergency number. What comes up? Nothing. So when you've
It's not even on Google.
It's not even on Google, so it doesn't exist. So when you come through the airport, even though we're taking your temperature and you may not be sick, we're giving you something to say, if you get sick, stay at home and call this number. We'll come to you. Don't come into our hospitals.
The White House held a briefing yesterday on the government's efforts to contain and control the Ebola outbreak here in the U.S. White House Homeland Security and Counterterrorism Advisor Lisa Monaco had this to say about the possibility of travel bans.
I'll take the travel ban question first. I know that has been something, an issue that has been raised. I take note of Dr. Frieden's comments in this regard, which is to say that, in fact, right now we believe those types of steps actually impede the response. They impede and slow down the ability of the United States and other international partners to actually get expertise and capabilities and equipment into the affected areas. And as we've said and stressed from this podium and others, the most important and effective thing we can do is to control the epidemic at its source. So what we want to be able to do is ensure we're getting the assistance, we're getting the expertise, and we're getting the providers into the affected region and not impeding that.
That was White House Homeland and Security Counterterrorism Advisor Lisa Monaco on the issue of travel bans. We will turn back to our phone lines now. We're going to hear from Richard in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on the Republican line. Richard, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, the people that are in the affected areas in Africa, it seems like I know probably I would do the same if people become desperate and they know they're going to die and they want to try to make it to the U.S. because of our great medical procedures. Before the fever actually, how long is the virus in the body before people notice they have a fever or before they have a fever? And also insects like flies and things like that. And can it be spread through flies landing on food? And it seems like I think we really should act on the side of caution for maybe a couple months or so to get a handle on it. And I think the airport, the UN or somebody around these airports in those affected areas would be before people leave. And also through air conditioning vents, like in airplanes, they have a return air that comes out to supply and things like that, is sneezes and vapors and things like that.
All right, Richard, we got your questions.
Yeah, Richard, you've raised two really important points there. Let's talk about when you talked about West Africa. We're seeing a lot of social mobilization. We are seeing a lot of community resilience. We're seeing a lot of community involvement in West Africa because they know that the community has to work together to beat Ebola. It's not just the doctors, it's the nurses, it's everyone. And again, when I was in Nigeria, I spent a lot of time with church leaders. And they were saying, how do we bring in faith and prayer as well as ensuring that no one gets Ebola? And again, we sat down, and I sat down with the nurses that were there and I said, well, if you're going to pray and you're going to be close to an Ebola patient, we need you to wear gloves. And then we need you to come out and we need to disinfect you with bleach. And we're not going to stop the prayer. We're not going to stop your faith, but we're going to bring evidence-based medicine into this. And if we now you mentioned about the spread and the transmission again, and again, we know that before, and this has been mentioned by the